Again, case number 21-1690, fraternal order of police against the Secretary of the Interior. Mr. Miller, please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you for working with me on video today. May it please the court, as a initial matter, I am aware that there was a jurisdictional question raised by the agency, I believe, on Monday. Since that issue was not briefed, I just wanted to start and, I guess, ask if that would be considered, or if arguments wish to be heard on that issue, I guess, before I get into the rest of the case.
Speaking for myself.
Are you prepared to discuss that issue? It does go to the foundation of this appeal.
Sure, and that's why I wanted to start with it. And, yes, I can touch on that briefly.
Please touch on it.
Sure. In reviewing the case cited by Appelese, I do agree that in its inception, it is similar to the matter at hand. There was a proposed disciplinary action of a federal employee, and they, through their collective bargaining agreement, invoked arbitration through their union. However, I believe that is essentially where the similarities end. In AFGE, the union on behalf of the employee prevailed, and therefore there was no further involvement of the federal employee, whereas in this matter, the arbitrator ruled in favor of the agency, and therefore the union is still representing Mr. Forbes in his proposed removal, whereas, as we're aware, in AFGE, that was solely for attorney's fees, was that appeal. I would briefly going through, I know the Hunt and Reese cases had been cited in the AFG opinion. I do believe the union easily meets the first two criteria to be representative as an association in this matter. The first, whether a member would otherwise have standing to sue in their own right. I believe the agency even conceded this in the letter on Monday that they believe that Mr. Forbes should have been the party named in this case rather than he had no ability to bring it at all. And certainly, again, this is Mr. Forbes' removal that we're speaking of, so I certainly do believe he had the right to appeal. And the second prong, if the interest it seeks to protect, or the union seeks to protect, are germane to the organization's purpose, I certainly believe that criteria is met by the union. This union's mission is specifically to represent officers in workplace issues, which necessarily and frequently involves disciplinary matters, such as the removal in this case. As to the third prong, whether the claims asserted or the relief requested requires participation of the individual members in the lawsuit, I would note that and I believe this was briefly brought up in the AFGE opinion, the only reason why the union was named as the petitioner in this case is because they were the only party that had the right to invoke arbitration in the first place of the removal. However, Mr. Forbes has been named specifically as a person in interest in all of the petitioner's briefs and in any documents that requested who else is involved in this case. I can represent Mr. Forbes is still clearly very, very much involved. I met with him yesterday to discuss these issues. I think that if the court does believe that Mr. Forbes should have been named as a party, I would just ask leave to recapture the filing because, again, he has consistently been named as a person of interest, and he certainly still is a part of this proceeding. Because I know that was the main issue, I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions then on that front.
Okay. Well, this is Judge Probst. I heard your analysis of AFGE. The case that it relies on is Reed versus Department of Commerce. So I'm not sure, except for the caveats on the end about how he's a person of interest, which would mean that you could arguably, and we'll ask the government about this, file a motion to join him. But otherwise, I think you're not disputing, right, that he needs to be part of this case under the statutory regime, which says this is just like the MSPB, and the MSPB refers to individual claims. I understand, as Judge Reyna said in his concurrence, it's a little anomalous because only the union can invoke arbitration, but I think we've been quite clear that notwithstanding that, this person has to be captioned and joined in this case. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that analysis, yes. Now that it has been raised, it does, yes, I would agree.
I appreciate that very much. But is your view, and we'll ask the I have no idea whether the government thinks there would be some reason that would foreclose your ability to move to join your client as a party at this juncture. We'll ask them, but I assume you would be amenable and ready, willing, and able to do that if that would cure the defect.
Yes, Your Honor, that
Thank
is correct.
You very much.
Then to move into the main issues of our appeal, and again, I'm aware everyone has read the brief, so I will not go through each detail. As you're aware, this is a removal case for two charges, failure to follow procedures, as well as conduct unbecoming. The conduct unbecoming had two specifications under that charge. One of the main issues we found in this case was, and we had mentioned at arbitration, was the overall timeliness of this matter. We certainly believe, and I know there is case law in this circuit about the timeliness provisions and what is timely. We do believe our client was prejudiced. There was, I believe, between the time the investigations were closed and the time discipline was actually proposed to be implemented, well over a year and a half that our client had sat waiting for the result of this matter, and even for the failure to follow procedures, I believe, was over 2 years. In that time, in our position, we don't believe that there can be no prejudice to our client when he had to sit that entire time and endure the mental toll and stress of having to wait and find out what was going to happen, as well as we believe the timeliness, the entire purpose of the provision is to prevent such a situation as that of these charges hanging over our client indefinitely. Nonetheless, even if the court also agrees with the arbitrator that the timeliness provision was not violated, we do believe that underscores the entire issues in this case, frankly. In this matter, again, without rehashing the time limits, our client for that entire year and a half, a little over that, was, while this process was going through, even when there was a protective order in place against my client, he still remained on duty. He was still coming into work every day, and the fact of the matter is if there had been no protective order entered, my client would have maintained his entire law enforcement
powers.
I'm
sorry, counsel. This is Judge Probst.
Sure.
Can I ask you about that? Because I think it's an interesting, important issue, which is I couldn't tell from the government can confirm it, but at least as of July 2018, that's the protective order time, right? Your client, I thought, was no longer in full duty status. Am I wrong about that?
You're correct. It's somewhat of a vague in-between. I believe it was called a restricted duty status. My client's essentially, he could no longer carry a firearm and badge. He didn't have his law enforcement authority, but he was still showing up to work every day. He was assigned, I believe, at one point to communications, at another point.
Yeah, but he wasn't performing the duties that his position required because he didn't have his firearm and his badge. So in the time frame? So from July 2018 forward, he was not on full duty status, right?
Partially. For the 1 year the protective order was in place, he was in that restricted duty status.
Okay.
However, the protective order ended, I believe, a few months prior to the agency proposing the removal. And in that time, my client was given his firearm and badge back and was actually training to go back to his normal position had there been no protective order.
So you're saying from approximately July of 2019 until October when the proposed removal was issued, he had his gun and his badge and was doing just everything.
Correct, okay. Your Honor.
Can I go back to the first point you were making? I didn't want to interrupt, but you were talking about the prejudice that your client suffered because of the time delay. I mean, I get that. Obviously, to have something hanging over you has some effect on you. But this isn't a circumstance where this was a circumstance where the alternative would have been that they had fired him earlier. I mean, you mentioned in your brief, for example, because during the interim he couldn't file for, you know, apply for promotions or whatever. But if you had your way, all that would have happened was they would have removed him a year earlier, in which case he wouldn't have been eligible to get the promotions anyway, right? You understand my point? I'm not seeing how the prejudice really, you know, although I'm, you know, I understand waiting is always, you know, a challenge, sure. Even if the waiting results in you're getting paid for a few more years than you otherwise would have if you had been fired 2 years earlier. I'm having a hard time putting that under the category of prejudice.
Sure. So on the one aspect, as to the removal, I mean, it certainly is our position that there was not enough substantial evidence in the record to support that conclusion. But to go to your point, yes, if the agency had tried to implement some sort of action earlier, then yes, we would be precluded from making that type of argument because he certainly didn't have to wait as long. So I do understand that. However, at the same time, when we're looking at Douglas factors such as the seriousness of the offense and including the supervisor's confidence in my client's abilities, I think that highly underscores the implication that the agency has presented that this is a terrible offense. We can no longer trust him to be a police officer when he was still showing up for work every day during that entire time frame. He was given his gun and badge back after the protective order. And briefly mention the protective order, by federal law, my client wasn't allowed to carry a firearm. So that's the reason it was taken away. Whereas, so arguably, if there had been no protective order, my client would have been in a full duty status up until October of 2019 when the proposed removal occurred. So on that front, we have difficulty understanding how the agency all of a sudden decides that this is such a, you know, terrible issue, my client can no longer perform his duties, et cetera, et cetera. And I think some of that also goes to the timeline in this matter that, you know, again, my client was going back to full duty. I didn't know if there was a question. I apologize. Again, after the protective order expired and my client was returning to full duty, you know, then the complainant in this matter went public with the video, and then all of a sudden the agency comes out a month later with the proposed removal. And so, I think that just underscores the seriousness of these allegations, that it appears that my client was ready to go back to duty as normal, and then all of a sudden he wasn't, and then there was publicity and the agency reacted. Without going into all the minor issues in our briefs, you know, again, we don't feel there was substantial evidence to meet the initial underlying charges. And on that, I still only have a couple minutes left at this point, so I'd be happy to take any questions if there are any.
Hey, my only
any questions for counsel?
Just if I might, thank you. You say small issues, but unless you prevail on the timeliness question, then we review for substantial evidence what the arbitrator did here. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what would the remedy be if we agreed with you that there was a timeliness violation?
If you were to agree with us as to the timeliness, I believe that would have prevented the removal from ever being posed, and then my client would return back to full duty and he'd receive back pay back to the date of his removal.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Right, let's hear from the other side, and you'll have some rebuttal time in any case. Mr. Jansen?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. We'll address the jurisdictional issue first. So,
Mr. Jansen, we can't hear you. Are you muted?
I don't believe I am.
Right. Try again.
May it please the Court, and I will address the jurisdictional issue first. So, as the court is aware, jurisdiction is not something that can be waived by the parties, and we believe that this court's recent decision in AFGE local.
Cut to the chase. Do you have a reason that it would not we could not cure whatever deficiency exists currently by your friend's client filing a motion to join at this juncture?
We don't believe that that is not the rule from AFGE local. The appeal was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction because only Mr. Fors could initiate this appeal under 7703 because he's the employee.
I don't understand. But that case involved attorney. And that was different. I mean, is it the government's view that at this juncture you're allowed to cure with a motion to join or not? We've got some cases that suggest, I think, that you can cure it, but I'd like to hear from you.
Yeah, our position is that at this juncture, you cannot cure the jurisdictional defect because only Mr. Forrest could have initiated the appeal in the amount of time required, and that is where the jurisdictional problem lies. So we can't substitute at this point Mr. Forrest for the union because the union was never a proper party to bring
this. Are you familiar with our case called Mentor versus Medical Device Alliance?
I don't believe that was said.
Okay. Well, I guess it's a tough issue. I do believe that arguably our case law would support a joinder. So tell us again why you're just saying you can't possibly cure this kind of deficiency.
I think under the rule that was recently announced, that was not an option because the appeal wasn't properly initiated by the correct party. And if an appeal isn't timely filed or properly initiated, that creates a jurisdictional issue, which cannot be cured.
Okay, can I just vent a little with you all? Because you did send us a 28J letter 2 days ago. So clearly we're way beyond the time, which if you're right, that he could cure it. But your 28J letter wasn't based on a change in law or something new and different. The case that you cited to us has been around for like 30 or 40 years. The Reed case was what it was predicated on. So I guess I'm a little sort of put off by the fact that you're the government. And if you thought there was a deficiency in the filing, and if you had known what you should have known then that you know now because the case law hasn't changed, why a notification then could have cured it. So I guess giving us the 28J letter on a non-prep case that just reiterates what the law has been for 30 years. Now maybe I should have caught it too, but I feel bad about that. But I guess don't you understand why it's a little off-putting the way this seems to have gone down?
I agree, and we do regret that this did not come to our attention sooner. And that should have been raised earlier in the briefing. We just did not see the Reed case.
Yeah, and it could have even been raised in enough time for him, the notice of appeal, you could have rejected that and given him enough time to do that. And certainly saved him, even if after that, I mean, the union or whoever's paying the bills here has gone through the cost of briefing and getting ready for this appeal for no good reason because your view of the law, which may in fact be right, is not changed.
We agree. And again, we regret that we did not raise this sooner. That said, of course, jurisdiction is an issue that we cannot waive, the parties cannot waive, and the court can consider at any time.
Well, can I ask you one other question? I mean, you haven't read the case that I'm citing, and I don't know whether I'm absolutely right or wrong, but in this Mentor case, and they cited a Supreme Court case, one of the basis for refusing joinder is in cases where you would have been prejudiced. The other side would be prejudiced by joinder. That would not be the case here, right?
That's correct. And we don't think the issues that are raised by this appeal would be substantially different, if different at all. As Mr. Miller pointed out, Mr. Forrest was identified as the real party in interest in his opening brief.
And so does the government have any reason to object to joinder or substitution of Mr. Forrest if the law allows it? Is it just you think the law doesn't allow it, but you have no other basis to object? Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And so if the court would also like to hear argument on the merits, I can turn to that as well. I'll just begin by saying the court does consider the merits here. You know, Mr. Forbes began as a patrol officer in 2014, and in that amount of time, this federal agency has twice proposed that he be removed from service, and the first time was within a year.
I'll just cut to the chase, okay, because we know the history of this. What about the argument your friend is making about if this was such a serious matter that warrants removal, why at least we've got a three-month period after the protective order, at least during the duration of the protective order, you took away his gun or whatever, suggesting that you didn't have confidence or you had some question about his ability to carry out his duties as assigned. But then, do you dispute, is your friend correct that from July of 2019 until the removal letter of October of 2019, he was in fact given his gun back and resumed regular duties?
Well, I don't agree with that characterization, and I would point the court to Commander Blight's testimony before the arbitrator as well as Chief Monahan's, because after the, actually as soon as this incident happened, Mr. Forbes and Officer Kingham were separated so that, because there was a concern about the conduct that was going on between the two of them, they were separated so that they could not interact with each other while they were on duty. And then subsequent to that, at some point, Mr. Forbes was actually moved to a different floor in a communications department role where he was not on patrol duty. He, at some point there then was his badge and his gun was taken away, but he was never put back into a patrol duty where he was unsupervised and out kind of interacting with the public. And as Commander Blythe testified to, she was, you know, urgently trying to complete this proposed removal action before the protective order expired so that there wouldn't be any question about him returning to a patrol duty. But he remained in this, in a communications role until his removal. So he did not go back to his pre-conduct role. But, you know, in addition to that, there wasn't a lot of legal reason for the agency to further restrict his duty after the protective order expired. Because as Your Honor pointed out, there hadn't been, the investigation was complete, but this process of proposing removal and going through those steps wasn't complete. And so the agency obviously has to allow their, you know, their process to play out and the due process rights afforded by the union and the agreement there to play out as well. So he was obviously
paid. He has complete control over that. They just have to hurry up and get the removal letter done. You put him on admin leave once you issue the proposed removal, right? And that's perfectly appropriate. No due process problem there.
Right.
So you have control on your end of that. I understand that it's a problem and that you have to be responsible about it, but it seems like you're the ones that control everything in that regard.
Up until the proposed removal, that is correct. And as Commander Blythe testified, though, to when you're talking about a proposed removal, unlike some of the other examples that were given where it's just a letter of reprimand or some other disciplinary action, the steps that you have to take just to get to that point are much more extensive, and everything has to go through legal, and it just takes sometimes a long time. And she offered an explanation as to why that took longer here. And I would also just point out that I believe Mr. Miller is incorrect when he says that the, you know, collective bargaining agreement itself says that if you are not timely in effectuating this removal, the removal can't happen. That is not provided for in the language of that agreement. It is section 18.2. It's a general provision that just says these actions should happen in a timely, or should be carried out in a timely fashion, but that is the extent of it. And this court's review of the agency's behavior, of course, is limited to a harmful procedural error. And there hasn't been any sort of connection drawn between the 20-month period and an effect that would have on the removal action itself. For example...
Well, is there another way to do it? I mean, let's assume there is a breach of the contract. The contract says you have to do it timely, and timely means no more than a year. outside of this arbitration, doesn't the union have a right to challenge that and to, you know, enforce the provision of the collective bargaining agreement?
Sure, and they can, and they did do that before the arbitrator. But then the other arbitrations decisions were looked at. But again, the collective bargaining agreement doesn't say anything about the consequence of not following that process. And we have examples from this court, the Brown case, in fact, where on a timeliness issue, it was found that the agency did not necessarily comply with all of their procedural processes, but at the end of the day, none of that affected the outcome or the substantial rights of the parties, and the removal was still to proceed because it just was not, it didn't rise to the level of a harmful error in the outcome here.
Is it the government's position that there is no limit on how long it can take in connection with this type of procedure under this agreement?
The limit would be showing a prejudice that actually affects the process or affects the outcome of the process.
It's not a certain amount of days or months.
No.
But it would be a showing that's, you say, absent here?
That's correct. And the disagreement here is Mr. Miller is pointing to a timeliness provision actually in the with respect to a disciplinary action, and that's necessarily going to be interpreted differently than the timeliness provision that would apply to a removal action, because that does take so much more time to effectuate and the consequences are just so much higher. And I think as Your Honor alluded to, we want the agency to take its time and to make sure a complete investigation is conducted and that due consideration and regard is given to these issues before a decision is made.
And prejudice would be what? I mean, the kind of thing would be prejudice is if witnesses take so long, so witnesses could die or not be available. And
correct. Or there's evidence that is no longer available, or in some way the appellant is not able to appropriately respond to the charges against them, or to participate in maybe the arbitration that would...
Can I take you back just a few minutes? You were citing the Blythe testimony.
Yes.
And I didn't see that cited in red. So do you have an appendix cite for that? For where we
sure.
Find it?
I do. And her testimony begins in appendix 264.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
And so if there are no further questions from the court, we respectfully request that this appeal be dismissed, or in the alternative, that the decision of the arbitrator be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions for Ms. Jansen?
No, thank you.
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Right. Mr. Miller, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to concede the remaining time. I think we made our arguments here.
Any questions for Mr. Miller?
I have none.
No. But just to reiterate that you indicated that your client was ready, willing, and able to file a motion to join?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission.